This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
All right, welcome. UCSB's Spring 2014 Lecture Series continues with David Hinke. Really excited to have David here. He's super accomplished, as you'll soon hear. He's got a lot of interesting thoughts to share with you on leadership. I'm going to quickly go over his bio, and you're going to see a pattern here. It's a pattern of winning. It's a pattern of picking winning teams and putting himself in situations where he could excel and his team could succeed as well. In 2009, David joined a company you might be familiar with, a small company called LinkedIn. He was the vice president of engineering and operations. For a couple years, he was responsible for all of technology. That wasn't enough, so he took on additional responsibility for the following 2.5 years, and he also ran operations, IT, data systems, security, et cetera. Kept doing that until 2013, in November, and he decided he should retire. Smart man. Prior to LinkedIn, David was a senior VP of engineering at Yahoo, and he did that for 4 years. Initially, he was responsible for engineering operations for Yahoo's search marketing group. And during that tenure, he was also responsible for the production operation infrastructure for the entire company. So you can imagine that's quite a stress level, 24/7. If the Yahoo site goes down, you think that might be an issue? Yeah, it might be. Before Yahoo, David ran engineering operations at Alta Vista, which was a search engine back in almost in the last century, but it was a big one. It's a very important one. And before that, he held development and management roles at Silicon Graphics. So again, four companies in a row, all of them successful. As if that wasn't enough, David is also an entrepreneur in his own right. He started two software companies, CAE Systems and Team One Systems, both of which were acquired. But I think the most important aspect of David's bio is the fact that he went to a little-known school near a beach called UCSB. Let's welcome Dave to our class.
Wow, thank you. That's the best applause I've ever gotten in my whole life. So before we start the proceedings, I'd like to get the age thing out of the way here. Raise your hand if you're 25 or under. Okay. Guess what? My children are 28 and 25. I graduated from University of California, Santa Barbara in 1978, before you were born. There was no computer science department here when I graduated. I was a mathematician. Things have changed a lot, but it's a great school. And one of the reasons I know it's a great school is we recruit from here. I know a lot of the professors here, and I insisted that LinkedIn came here. So I was responsible for UCLA, Caltech, Berkeley, and I said, now we're going to UCSB too. You're every bit as good as any one of those schools, and remember that. All right, so let's get to the genesis of the talk. I'm going to talk about leadership, but when we get to the questions, you can ask me anything you want. I've been grilled for the last 3 hours, thanks to you. Where are you?
Cassidy.
So I've been doing nothing but answering questions all day. And so I'm going to make this really quick, and then we'll go right to Q&A, which I think is the best part of the program, because you can ask me anything you'd like to. The genesis of this leadership deck is actually important to us. I was at LinkedIn, the greatest company I ever worked at. And at LinkedIn, one of our biggest problems was training our leaders. It was hard enough to bring in the engineers. So we had actually had 200 engineers when I got there. When I left, there were 2,000. That's called hypergrowth. 4 years, 200, 2,000. But that wasn't our biggest problem. Our biggest problem was getting enough leaders to be able to train those people and get those people to do the right things. And that's why this is important. So I actually taught this at LinkedIn University, because there hasn't been up till now, hopefully we're going to get there, university courses that could teach this sort of thing. Last week, and was Friday of last week, my brother-in-law is a commander in the LA County Sheriff. He retired. But he has a program where he teaches lieutenants in the state of California. So guess what I did last Friday? I gave this speech to 25 lieutenants from the San Francisco Police Department, Oakland PD, San Diego PD, LA County Sheriff, and so forth and so on. Now, one might ask yourself, well, what do they have in common with the new leaders of our next generation? And the answer is everything. Leadership is leadership, whether you're a police officer, whether you're a superintendent of schools, whether you're in technology, whether you're in a company, whether you're at the university, it's all the same to me. So that's the genesis of this. This quote comes from our, at least I got it, I steal everything, from the CEO of LinkedIn. The ability to inspire others to achieve a shared objective. That's Jeff Weiner, 101. We care deeply about that. So what I'm going to do in this presentation is talk about three leaders. I am in no way comparing myself to the greatest leaders of all time, but I'm going to talk about Abraham Lincoln, I'm going to talk about Steve Jobs, who I met, and I'm going to talk about the way I think about this. We're going to talk about principles, and then we're going to talk about how we apply those principles to actually get this stuff to work. So I'm showing you a picture of Mr. Lincoln for one reason. These are the people. These are his people. He was a man of the people. And this actually comes out of a book. So I'm just basically taking this right out of the book about the art of leadership. So Lincoln, I'm not going to go through all these. You can read it at your leisure. I'm going to talk about a couple of them. Circulate amongst the troops. Lincoln understood that from top to bottom, from general to private, he actually had to know what was going on. I used to work for a company called Hewlett-Packard. Everybody knows Hewlett-Packard? It's named for two great engineers, Mr. Hewlett and Mr. Packard. They had two principles. One of their principles was called management by walking around. They would literally walk around every one of their buildings, and they would tap people on the shoulder. And they would say, "What are you doing?" I got tapped once. I was just lucky. I was a junior engineer. "What are you working on?" They cared so much about what the engineers were doing that they did this. That's the same principle. I'm not going to go through all of them, but there's a couple that are very important to me. Set goals and be results-oriented. You're going to see this whether you're at the university, whether you're in a company. It doesn't matter. But you have to actually know what you're trying to achieve and go after it. Obviously, Lincoln had goals that were probably more paramount than many of us will ever see. But he was very, very good at it. Encourage innovation. I thought this was an interesting one. You would think, well, what does a politician have to do with innovation? But Lincoln had to think of things that had never been thought of to get people to do things that they never thought they could do in probably the worst position in the history of the United States. Master the art of public speaking. I'm not a very good public speaker, by the way. The over-under on the F word is 2, if you've made a wager. But I was told not to use this because it's on TV tonight. Fortunately, in my prior meetings, I was allowed to do it because there was no television. Lincoln was an introvert. He wasn't a very good public speaker. He had to train himself how to be a public speaker. And if you can't inspire the team, then you're not going to be a leader. Jeff Weiner has a all hands worldwide, 6,600 employees, 26 companies in the world. I'm sorry, 26 offices in the world. Every 2 weeks, he goes over everything we're doing for the whole company. He has mastered the art of public speaking. I have not. They occasionally would bring me up, and I was often asked not to use the F word. But I do care deeply about what we're doing. And the nice thing about public speaking is you can reach a lot of people. When you're a growing enterprise like LinkedIn, you have new people coming in all the time. So we also have to reinforce it. Lincoln was also a storyteller, and he would influence people through conversation and storytelling. He would use metaphors, and we're going to use some metaphors today when we talk about some of the applications. And preach a vision and continually reaffirm it. So this is what really happened. The worst show in the history of the United States. That's not the F word. and I got to tell you something. I don't know if you guys have seen the movies with Daniel Day-Lewis or watched public television. It's an incredible thing. More Americans died in this war than any than all the other wars combined for Americans. And it's because we were fighting each other. So what do you do? He needed a vision. He needed a plan. He needed to figure out what he's going to do. And at first, it was an economic argument. But then he realized there was something more important underneath the covers, and it was about slavery. So he does the Emancipation Proclamation, a great speech, right? And then he does another great speech called the Gettysburg Address, right in the middle of this terrible, terrible, terrible war where we're killing each other. He walked the front lines. I told you he talked to his generals and lieutenants, but he also went in and talked to the privates because he wanted to know. And that's something I do all the time. I always go to the engineers first for two reasons. They actually know what the hell's going on. That's reason one. Reason two, they usually have better ideas floating up than coming down. The feedback loop this way is very, very important, and Lincoln knew that. This is one of my favorite parts, right? There were two great generals in this war when they started it. General Lee was considered the greatest West Point graduate of all time. In this case, he was fighting for the South. McClellan was fighting for the North, a genius. But he wouldn't fight. And Lincoln knew it. So what did he do? He had to make an executive decision. He had to change his leadership out. So he hires a drunk who happens to be a fighter. And he put him in charge, and he won the war. The final thing is he never lost his resolve. There were some good times and bad times, mostly bad times during this war. But Lincoln never gave up. And he made sure he pushed it all the way through. And that's why I consider him the greatest leader in the history of the United States. So here's another guy. I got to meet this guy. So imagine we're doing a Yahoo meeting with 100 leaders of Yahoo, and Yahoo's having all kinds of problems. So they stick 100 people in a room, and Jerry Yang, the current CEO and founder of Yahoo, brings in his friend, Mr. Steve Jobs. So Jobs comes into the room, and I took copious notes. My notes were so good that I sent them to Jerry Yang. I said, just do what he said. He knows what he's doing. These are the few things that stood out for me. He was very, very focused, and I'll explain that in a second. Know your DNA. Every company has a DNA. Do you think, what is Google's DNA? Search and advertising. What is Facebook's DNA? Social media. Do you think that Facebook is a search company? Do you think Google is a social media company? I don't think so. Jobs knew his DNA. Run the company like a small company. I don't care if you get to be 20,000 or 100,000 like Microsoft. You still run it like a small company, and you'll always have control. Management is always the problem. I love this. He actually lined up the 100 leaders of Yahoo. 1-0, 1-0, 1-0. And he went around the whole room, walked the whole room. Zeros leave the room, you're fired. He actually said that to us. And I'm thinking to myself, wait, you can't do that. And he goes, I absolutely can do that. And that's the right thing to do. Because the engineers are never the problem. The leads are never the problem. It's the leaders that are always the problem. Passion for products and services. I don't know about you guys, but I've been waiting 35 years for this puppy. I had to have my daughter explain to me how to use it because I'm not that great at these new devices. But frankly, I'm really happy they did it. And I thank Mr. Jobs for this. It's a hell of a thing. And never forget what you already had, your core assets. He kept reminding Yahoo, you're not like me. You have all the money in the world. You have great engineers. You run great services. What is your problem? And he's literally yelling at us. So here's what he did. I don't know if you guys have read his biography, but Apple was 3 months away from bankruptcy. Even Gates from Microsoft put money in just to keep them afloat. 3 months away. We're going out of business. And he did. He said, we're going to focus. So we're not going to do the PDA. We'll do the iPod. Instead of 16 computer lines, we're going to do 4 computer lines. We're not going to do... We're going to go for the end users. The end users are our best customers. They love these devices. They love the Macs. We're not going to go to the enterprises. He got rid of most of his management, as I said before. His passion, I don't know if you know this, Toy Story. I know the guy who did Toy Story, John Lasseter, came from my high school. Great artist. They delayed Toy Story because Jobs didn't like it enough. It wasn't right. It wasn't perfect. He did the same thing with all his products. If it wasn't just the way he wanted it, he was a little anal about it, but if it wasn't the way he wanted it, he wouldn't ship it, whether it's a movie or an iPhone. Passion for his employees. I love this. He actually said, I want every one of my employees to be able to buy their house for cash. Now, that's a hell of a thing to say. I'm not sure that's true at Apple, but he wanted it because he knew how hard they were working. He knew they were passionate like he was, and he wanted to make sure they were also rewarded for that. And never forget what you already have. We talked about that. All right, so I actually have my own axioms. Most of them are plagiarized. Some of them I invented myself. I have many more than this, but these are some that are important to me. What gets measured gets fixed. I told you I worked for Hewlett-Packard. Hewlett-Packard, before they made computers and printers, they made measuring devices, oscilloscopes, things like that. And this was the primary adage, what gets measured gets fixed. If we don't know how to measure it, and we don't measure it, we have no idea how to fix it. So that's huge to me. The code doesn't lie. The code, you can replace the code with the data. The data doesn't lie. Only you guys lie and I lie. The code and the data don't lie. That's the truth. That's la verdad. Quality schedule features, pick two. This is a very important concept in management. You have this tension when you're building services and products. The tension is between the product guys who want to build everything, the engineers who want it to work correctly, the sales guys who want to put it out there as fast as possible. So, but I told Jeff Weiner, you can only pick two. He says, I want all three. I said, that's not the drill, Jeff. You only get to pick two. Figure out and get that tension working so that we can decide what we want to do. By the way, you guys can all have access to this information. I am going through mine. There are three kinds of feedback, positive, negative, and none. Only one of them is bad. Which one? None. Okay, so I was getting some from Klaus over here about LinkedIn services, but at least it's feedback. It's, in this case, it's a little negative feedback, and he wants me to bring it to the attention of the LinkedIn engineers and product people. I'm okay with that. That's good. The only kind of feedback that's bad is when you don't tell me anything that I don't know what to do. Long-term vision, short-term execution. I learned this from the CEO of Silicon Graphics, Ed McCracken. He said, you have to have this vision that goes way the hell out there, but then you execute against it just like this, little by little, and you keep track and make sure you're still on that line. And for many years, this worked for Silicon Graphics. Cautionary trail. Silicon Graphics went bankrupt. Remember that, and I can explain that and if you want to go later deeper in that. This one I got from my brother. So my brother-in-law is a superintendent, or I'm sorry, a commander-in-chief, a commander in the sheriff. My brother was the superintendent of the Montebello Unified School District, right east of downtown Los Angeles, 95% Mexican-American, pretty difficult place to come from. I myself come from Whittier. There's many gangs in Whittier as well. And in this case, my brother always says to me, don't worry about the mule being blind, just load the wagon. What he says is, sometimes you just do the work. Quit complaining. Quit aggravating. Quit being in a paralysis state. Just load the wagon. So going back to, I'm a Laker fan, by the way. I have Lakers season tickets. Any Laker fans? Bad year, but we're coming back. So I'm sitting there at the Laker game with my brother, and he's got his device, and I've got my device. And I got a priority zero problem. My network's down. I'm off the air. My brother has a priority zero problem. Guess what his is? Shooting at his school. You guys just had a priority zero problem. I used to live in Isla Vista. That was a priority zero problem. What do you think is worse? My brother's priority zero problem or mine? His is. Just load the wagon. You're only as good as your lieutenants. I was so happy I had this one in here for the lieutenants. I talked to 25 lieutenants. They really are lieutenants. I can be the greatest, I can think I'm the greatest leader on the planet. If I can't build a team, that's not great, then I can't possibly do it. I'll give you a little side note. I just had a retirement party in November, and they brought 15 of my family, and God knows why, and they put them in with 22 of my engineering leaders at LinkedIn. The proudest moment for me was I looked at the 22, and of the 22, five of them were there before I got there. The other 17 I hired personally. Personally, I closed them. They're my team. They're probably better off without me at this point. They're so smart. By the way, they're all smarter than I am too. Way smarter than I am. That's also an important thing. You hire the best team, you're going to have the best outcome. This one is a personal one. For those of you who speak Spanish, dime con quién andas y te diré quién eres. Tell me who you run with and I'll tell you who you are. A lot about you and you and you is the people you're running with and the way you act around each other. And that gets back to the team itself. If I ran with that team and I walked the floor and I knew every single engineer in that company, it's a big deal to me. The Four Agreements is a personal one. This is it's more of a philosophical book. You can use it as a leader. You can use it in your personal life. Or you choose not to use it at all. This is a book that is mandatory reading for my leaders. They have to read this book. Ruiz was a Toltec, predated the Aztecs. He has basic four principles. Do your best. You guys are already doing your best. You wouldn't be here if you weren't doing your best. I'm not too worried about that. Be impeccable with your word. Impeccable is Latin, which means without sin. That means the truth matters. And you've got to get as close to the truth as you can. I think most of us are pretty good at that. Don't assume anything. This is Ops 101. Don't assume anything. Trust but verify. As soon as you assume it and it's not true, you're screwed. And if you're trying to run a team, you're going to be screwed a lot. Don't take anything personally. So David Filo, the founder of Yahoo, I worked for him for part of the time I was there. Great engineer. He called me an idiot 100 times. I said, David, I am responsible for 550 people. I'm responsible for the biggest budget for the data centers, the networks, the computers, a million computers, for the whole company. If I am an idiot and you are my boss, and you have given me this responsibility, what are you? Don't take it personally. Most of the time when people say something to you, it's much more about them than it is about you. And it's very important because it's especially when you're struggling to do hard work in a company, things are going to happen. And you just got to let it go. So I'm going to use the example of Overture, which was Yahoo, to explain how my principles come into play for leadership. I was retired for 4 years after Alta Vista, and I wanted to be there for my children, who at the time were freshmen and sophomore in high school, the one time they did not want me there. In fact, I used to drive them to school in a 65 Dodge pickup, and they would make me drop them off way before we got to the school, so no one would see us in such a terrible vehicle. I love this truck. I don't know why they didn't like it. But anyway, I came back to work for Yahoo, and they sent me down to Pasadena and then Burbank, because the thing that was responsible for half of Yahoo's money was failing. It's called sponsored search or search marketing. So you do a little search of cameras in the search engine. You see those links at the top? Those are advertisements. You click on those links, Yahoo makes money. Microsoft makes money. And Google makes a pile of money. And they're real good at it. Ours was failing. The legacy systems were failing. And I had to decide, do I try to fix the legacy systems or do we build a new one? And it came down to Team A, you're going to build me a new one. Team B, you're going to keep this puppy alive. And little Team C, you're going to make sure that I can get 450,000 advertisers with half of Yahoo's money from here to here without dropping a penny on the floor. So what was the problem? We actually came up with a thing. We called it Panama, the project. It had failed twice, by the way. They had tried and failed twice. That's why they brought me out of retirement to see if I could do it. So I go in there, and the first thing I notice is they have 27 people working on the second failure. And I went to the CTO, and I said, I need 500, and I cannot hire them. I need you to give me the best and brightest from the rest of Yahoo. So we actually had to build a team, right? What was the problem? I'm going to now compare this with the Panama Canal, because, by the way, it's another great read. That's why I like the Panama analogy. What was the biggest problem with building the Panama Canal? They couldn't keep the workforce alive. They were all dying of malaria and yellow fever, and they didn't understand the root cause, which in this case was mosquitoes transmitting it from place to place, right? So they couldn't keep their workforce alive. I didn't have a workforce. I had to go beg, borrow, and steal from the rest of Yahoo. I took people from Mail, from Search, from Messenger. I was not a very popular person with the rest of the group. So the next thing we did was we created a vision, we built a plan, we kept the workforce alive. Then we had to come up with an engineering solution that worked. The problem with sponsored search was we gave the bids to the highest bidder. We gave the links to the highest bidder. Google figured out highest bidder times click-through rate is actually the best thing to show, the best ad to show. Ads are no different than search results. They're either relevant or they're not. Google understood this. And we had to rebuild it. And we had to create engineering solutions that could rebuild it. In the Panama Canal, the French had left. They built a third of it. They left. They left everything. They almost went bankrupt as a country. And Teddy Roosevelt, to his credit, said, well, it's too militarily advantaged to us, so we got to go in and do it. But they didn't have an engineering solution that would work. So the French had built the Suez Canal connecting two seas. But now we're connecting two oceans with tides. But the worst problem with the Panama Canal was it rained. It was a tropical rainforest. So every time they would dig the trench, it would fill in every time it rained. And they get two steps forward, three steps back, and they didn't know what to do. So it was a Frenchman that came up with an engineering solution. He said, we're going to build a lake at the top of this thing, and we're going to trap all the water in there, and then we're going to use the water to raise and lower the boats in a lock system. It was brilliant. They took away the worst problem they had, which was the rain, and they used it as a renewable energy resource to actually make the canal work. We had to do the same thing with Panama. We had to come up with a solution that could compete with Google, because if we didn't, we'd be out of business. Invest in the infrastructure to do it. So when they built the Panama Canal, they actually built railroads that ran 24/7. They built steam shovels that had never been built before. When we built Panama, we built software to actually build the software and run the software and do the QA and the testing and the everything we needed to do. And we actually had to build it from scratch because it didn't exist. Even the rest of Yahoo didn't have what we needed. And we actually had to build our own infrastructure. Then we constantly reinforced the vision and the next milestone. So this is a good example. It took many, many years to build the Panama Canal, and there were many setbacks. Well, it took over a year to build the Panama replacement for Yahoo. And I was the one who was required. I was the one who wrote the whole spec. It was my program. I wrote a 25-page document that said, either we're going to do this or we're not. If we're going to do it, this is the checklist for making this thing work. And I'll never forget, we're getting close, and my boss, the big boss, comes up and he says, we need to ship this. And I said, but we haven't gone through the checklist. And he says, well, let's start taking things off the checklist. And he's sitting in front of all my lieutenants, my boss and my lieutenants. And he says, let's take this out. Let's take this out. At that point, there's another adage that I didn't put. Go to work every day willing to be fired. That's the way I think about it. I took my badge and I threw it right at him. And I walked out. Because if you're going to undo everything I've tried to achieve with quality to get this thing to work, then you picked a fight with the wrong guy. We settled our differences, kissed and made up, apologized to the team. It wasn't very professional of me to do that. But there was a point being made there. We were at a critical point. We had to reinforce what we were trying to achieve. So when the Panama Canal was almost done, there's a little place called the Culebra Cut, very steep. Culebra is Spanish for snake. Another rain hits. It fills in with dirt, and they're trying to decide what to do. And the local engineer goes to the chief engineer, and he says, "What are we going to do?" And the chief engineer says, what the hell do you think you're going to do? You're going to dig. We had to say this many times in our project. There were highs and lows. We managed it every day. We had a meeting every day to decide what we were going to do next. And we kept digging. And then we finally shipped it. And we doubled Yahoo's revenue. And we could compete again. So that actually worked for us. And I was very proud of that. By the way, as a side note, the chief engineer on that project is a guy named Brian Acton. You guys follow the internet? WhatsApp? Facebook? WhatsApp just got bought by Facebook for $19 billion. Brian Acton is the founder of WhatsApp. And we couldn't be happier for him at Yahoo because he deserved it. And I'm not sure it's worth $19 billion, but he deserved what he got, and we were all very proud of him for that. And it just shows you somebody, we didn't succeed at the end of the long day. We didn't really succeed at Yahoo. And Brian Acton was engineer number 42 at Yahoo. But now he's at WhatsApp, and he's doing pretty well. So let's hear it for Brian Acton. Woo! Okay, so these are some questions you should ask yourself. There's an important statement in here for me. One of my engineers, a guy who worked for me for 4 years at Alta Vista and 4 years at Yahoo, is an introvert. And I told him, never act like me. We can believe in the same principles, but if you start acting like me, one, it's bad enough there's one of me, but if there's two of me, it's going to be show. And secondly, that's not who you are. So you're going to be your own leader. You're going to be your own leader, and it's going to come from within here. That doesn't mean you don't have principles for what that we agree to, but you're going to have to decide how to do it for yourself. And I encourage you to think about that. And I encourage you to think, find somebody you admire. I obviously showed you two people I admired and why. And find that person, and then maybe they could be your mentor. Maybe they can interact with you. I don't know how that'll work, but I will tell you, that's the way it's supposed to work. But find it from within. So I actually am going to go over this bibliography quickly, because I actually care about these books. I already talked about the Four Agreements. The Goal. Has anybody read The Goal? Okay. It's mandatory reading in all business. And it's effectively about... it's about the theory of constraints and throughput. But in a nutshell, what it says is, if every team is optimizing for themselves, you will have a suboptimal system. When you're working in a company, something might have to be suboptimized so that we can get throughput for the whole thing. And this is a very difficult problem. And this other book down here, Conscious Business, talks about this. We're all interested in our team or us achieving what we said we were going to do. But if it's in spite of the other team, it will not work. And people have to recognize that. So I used to walk around Yahoo, and I'd hear us and them conversations. And it would be team one against team two at Yahoo. And I would stop it. And I said, there's only one us and one them. Us is Yahoo and them is Google. What part of that don't you get? That's how you have to think when you're working in a company. It's the team. The team that matters the most. And if you're willing to do that, you'll become the best leader of all. Because great leaders understand the people that understand the team. And that's key to me. Lincoln on Leadership, we talked about. The Art of War, famous book. It's a book about war by a famous Chinese philosopher, but it applies to business. Most business people, this is like the Bible to them. And I'll leave it at that. Mythical Man Month, it's about project management. It's old school, but it actually works. We have the new Agile development. I got asked that in one of the prior sessions, but it's actually a good read too. The Path Between the Seas, that's just the Panama Canal book. It's 1,000 pages. I'm a slow reader. It was like watching a movie. Couldn't believe it. Read it. Conscious Business. I know this man, Fred Kaufman. He now is a VP at LinkedIn. I thought, I got nothing left to learn. I'm an old dog. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. This guy taught me many, many things in the last 2 years. Read his book. It's a little complicated, but it's incredibly good. Startup of You, I just a little plug for Reid Hoffman. I also have my own memos, so we can talk about that too. I got asked a lot about entrepreneurship. In 1998, I wrote a memo called So You Want to Join a Startup, and I wrote it for the engineers that were leaving Silicon Graphics to go to companies like Netscape at the time. And it's still relevant, and I actually use it in retention, but I also use it to just make sure that people understand what the do's and don'ts and due diligence are for joining a startup. I was in two startups. I was the founder. It's very interesting to me, especially engineers, how smart they are, and yet when it comes to deciding things like this, they really don't think through the problem. So what happened is I posted on my last day at SGI to SGI Bad Attitude, which is the place that all the engineers complain about people like me. And sure enough, it leaks out onto the internet within seconds. And I get 5,000 emails from people I don't know. And it said, I read your memo and I joined the startup anyway. I read your memo and I didn't join the startup. I wished I had read your memo before I joined the startup. That was the one I was trying to get to. And so that's all good. This one, Everyday Monday's Operations, I actually wrote this while LinkedIn. I can't publish it because I'll probably be sued. But it has 10 operational principles in everything that ever happened, good, bad, and ugly, at Alta Vista, Yahoo, and LinkedIn. And I'm trying to figure out a way to clean it up so that I won't get sued. But that one I'm very particular about distribution on. All right, I'm going to leave it there, and now I expect the hardest questions in the world from you.
Lead us off with an incredibly compelling question. Come on, first time's the hardest, but it's the best.
Wow.
Are you kidding me? I'll start, but you're next. So, David, tell us about any mentor. I'm a big mentor guy. Tell us about any mentors in your career. How did you foster that relationship? Or people that you mentored, how they fostered it with you?
Okay, so I actually am a mentor for many people at LinkedIn. The greatest person I ever worked for or with in my life is a guy named Dr. Qi Lu, Q-I space L-U. He was what I consider the greatest Yahoo of all time. He is now running all of Microsoft's internet division and office. God knows why he chose to do that, but I love the man, and I don't like the company he's working for as much as I love this man. But he was my mentor, and he is completely different than me. He's much smarter. He's harder working than even I am. And which is hard to believe for me, and he's humble. I'll tell you a little story about him. He's famous for working incredible hours. So I actually wrote a cron job, and I pinged him effectively on the hour, every hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 1 week. And I sent him a random email. And unless he wrote a program cron job back to reply to mine, he was up all but 4 hours of every day working. Incredible man. So check him out, Qi Lu on the internet. He was my mentor. And part of it was he was not like me. He brought things to me that I hadn't considered, that I hadn't thought through. And that's the relationship there. For me, the other side is a lot of people want to know, you know, what I do and why I do it. And I got to be very honest with you. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And make sure you understand that just because I said so doesn't make it so. But at least we have a good dialogue. And in a mentorship program, people want to know. They ask questions. And we can talk about specific questions that they have, or we can talk about their career trajectory. LinkedIn cares deeply about your career. Every member. Members come first. We care about your career. We want you to transform it. Well, if I can't do that for my own employees, then boy, how the hell can I do it for the rest of LinkedIn's membership? And so it was very important for us to actually talk about the career path. We're trying to get into the universities in a big way. Why? You're pre-professionals. You're going to be a professional soon. Do you care about your career? Of course you do. Do we care? Of course we do. Do the companies that are going to hire you care? Or the universities that you're going to be working for care? Of course they do. So to me, we're trying to create a formal, actually, mentorship program at LinkedIn, but they didn't formalize it. And that was the one thing that I hope Fred Kaufman will help LinkedIn with. And that's how do we sort of codify this in a better way so that I'm not doing it one way, and this other executive's doing it another way.
What do you think the most important quality to have to be like a young entrepreneur?
To be a what?
To be a young entrepreneur.
A young entrepreneur. Okay, so we actually I got asked that question. Probably the one quality for me is, I know it's going to sound a little corny, is perseverance. So there are good days and there are bad days, and things go wrong. But you have to persevere. You have to believe in what you're doing. You have to be passionate. Edison, I think, is quoted as saying 90% perspiration, 10% inspiration. Being an entrepreneur, you have to do many things, and you have to work, in many cases, really, really hard. But if you have the passion and perseverance to do it, you will succeed. And you just got to keep pushing. You can never give up. Never give up.
When in doubt, dig.
Share some of your points that you outlined in One to Join a Startup.
Yeah, I can talk about some of them. So the first thing that people think about in startups, the first thing you should think about is the same thing you should think about any company. You should understand the people that are in that company, right? And who they are and what they're trying to achieve and whether it's their culture. LinkedIn has a very, and it's in the deck later in the appendix, I can show it to you. LinkedIn has a very, short description of our culture. Right, you have to know the people, and they have to be the best people on the planet, and you have to have cultural fits with them. And I'm not saying this culture is better than that culture. I like LinkedIn's culture better than any company I ever worked at. As good as we were at Silicon Graphics, we were arrogant. I didn't like that part about our culture. So the people come first. That's the first and foremost thing, because you can have the best idea on the planet or the best business model you've ever seen, but if you don't have the right people, you're dead in the water. Dead in the water. People, talent is the highest priority for LinkedIn. Always, and it should be the highest priority for anywhere you work. The second thing is you got to understand that at some point you're creating a product or a service that at some point has to make money, right? And I don't know if you remember the dot-com bust of the old days, but there were a lot of companies that were in what I call the going out of business. So I was part of one of them. I had Alta Vista, but we were also responsible for shopping.com. We spent a dollar for every 90 cents we made. I mean, do the math. I'm spending a dollar to make 90 cents. The more dollars I spend, the faster I'm out of business. That's called the going out of business. That's a terrible business model. Make sure, even if you're the engineer, you talk to the business people. You know who convinced me to go to LinkedIn? Not Reid Hoffman, not the CEO. The CFO convinced me, a guy named Steve Sordello. He opened the books for 4 hours. And I went through the businesses. And this was, you know, in the early days of LinkedIn. I thought, oh my goodness. This is a beautiful thing. We've got these great members who give us this great data where we can answer great questions and get great value and make a pile of money. And that's a technical term. Trust me on that. It's a lot of money. So understand the business. Understand the technology. If it's a technology company, you better have great technologists and it better be defensible. Right? So if it's a small company, maybe you've got patents that you can file. Maybe you can protect yourself. Understand that as well. The other thing, well, one more thing. The other thing you have to understand is you get offered, and this I cover this in this little memo too. You get offered something, and I guarantee you it's going to make you a millionaire at that price. And that's an incentive for a lot of people. They might want to be the next Mark Zuckerberg. Do the math. Do an expected value calculation. You guys take math, right? I got this percent chance of hitting this valuation in this time. This percent chance of hitting this valuation in this time. Trust me, it's not going to be the number they told you when they recruited you. And I wanted to make sure all my engineers knew that. Here's the honest offer. Here's the real deal. I did the same thing with Wiener when I joined LinkedIn. I made him do an expected value calculation, and I did mine. Of course, mine came in lower. I'm more conservative. But he still met my numbers. And that's the way to do it. You had one more?
Yes. You said that you studied math, but you take care of engineers. So how do you go about managing the engineers when you probably haven't studied?
Well, remember, there wasn't a computer science department.
Real quick to repeat it. So you were a math major. You managed engineers. How did you do that?
Yeah, so... By the way, I consider mathematics, let me put it this way. I graduated number one from the University of California in mathematics because I outworked everybody. And I wasn't the best mathematician, so that gets back to the perseverance thingy. Mathematicians were taught how to think. When I first left the university and I started my companies, I didn't hire computer science majors. You know why? They were taught to program badly. I hired nuclear engineers, physicists, chemical engineers, mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, because I could teach them how to program, but I couldn't teach them how to think. They needed to be trained how to think. So I have no problem dealing with the engineers. Remember, I wrote software for the first 25 years of my career. I wasn't a leader. I never wanted to be a leader. I was one of the engineers. So I, as a mathematician, the only thing I did differently was at the end of the long day, I took a lot of computing classes because I realized either I'm going to be an actuary, a professor, or I'm going to go into a private enterprise. And I decided that the third choice was it. But to get into that, I had to learn computer programming. And I loved it. I loved to be a programmer. Did it for 25 years.
Next question right here. Speaking of
speaking of perseverance and how important that is, because we're going to have those bad days, are there any good indicators of we're working for a failed startup and it's time to leave versus a good startup
that's a very
and we
good
should
question.
Continue?
When you, well, first of all, there's basic metrics. Remember, what gets measured gets fixed. So one question, and I talk about some of this in that memo, although, again, it's kind of dated. You should understand their financing. What was their first financing? Do they have another round coming? Remember, I'm on the board of directors of four companies. You don't think we talk about this all the time? Of course we do. What's your burn rate? How many people have you hired? What's your break-even point? I mean, if you don't have a break-even point or you're going to continue to lose money more than you gain money for the rest of your lives, trust me, you're not going to last very long. Are your leaders being transparent with you? Good, bad, or ugly, you got to know what's going on day for day, week for week, month for month. And if you smell a rat, start asking questions. LinkedIn is an incredibly transparent company. I told you this. We have every other week we have an all hands for all 26 offices. And the one thing I didn't think Jeff Weider could pull off was actually talking about everything, including finances and how we're doing. Because, you know, we got to keep it close. We don't want any people getting accused of any, you know, insider trading or anything. But he's very transparent, and he's kept that culture alive to the best of his ability under the law. And if you don't see that, then there's something wrong with the culture of your company. If they're not being transparent, they're hiding something, time to go. Don't waste your time.
Yeah, so I'm actually curious about a certain portion of starting up a business, and that involves, you know, the market research and learning your market. As a leader, how do you lead your team into learning their market to get it out if, say, it's kind of a pioneer industry, like you're the first in that field without competition? How do you go about learning your market?
Well, some of it you have to experiment. I mean, you know, LinkedIn's actually a great example. There's no direct competitor, really. And some of it we learned, and some of it took us a long time to learn to figure out what to do. And it's no longer a startup, although we do like to believe we still have the startup mentality, and we support that. I think you have to be able to experiment. You also have to build infrastructure to experiment and see what works and see what doesn't work. So a good example at LinkedIn, I don't know if you know it, but I was running over 1,000 A/B tests live on the site right now. You don't know it, but I do. But we had to build infrastructure to test out our theories. You have a theory, that's great. Where's the data to back it up? All right. And the nice thing about the internet is you can get an awful lot of data in a very short amount of time, and you can figure out that works, that didn't. Facebook does this all the time. They're real good at it too. Use the data. Let the data drive the argument, and then it'll help the team understand it. Because if you say X and I say Y, that's just your opinion and my opinion. Let's let the data show what's going on, and let's run the experiments. But you also have to invest in the infrastructure to do that. LinkedIn, a good example. Half of our infrastructure is just computing data. It's not running the site. It's crunching data 24/7 on Hadoop grids. Half of the computers are just crunching data so that we can get answers to our questions. That's all we do, and we're really, really good at it.
You said leaders persuade rather than coerce. What if you have multiple leaders on a team or people that feel that they are the leader? How do you deal with that, and how could you deal with like a team of entrepreneurs, like if we were making teams in this class?
Oh, by the way, that was from Lincoln. So the great example there for me is coercion is sort of a negative term, right? Persuasion is, let me make an argument. One of the best things I ever did, or I like to do, is I like to get you to think about this idea, and then it becomes your idea, and you get all the credit. As a leader, I take the blame, my people get the credit. Because at the end of the day, if I can persuade them that this is a way to do it, and they now believe they own this, they'll take great pride in this, and we'll get the thing accomplished. Because all I want to do is win, right? And that's why you have to understand that people are motivated in different ways. I'll give you a slightly different example. In my first startup, I wrote most of the code, 70%. But there was one guy, older guy, even older than me, that wrote a lot of the database layer code. And he was going to leave the company. And I said, Bob, why are you leaving the company? I said, do you want more stock? No. Do you want more salary? No. Do you want title? No. Do you want to manage a team? No. What do you want? He said, I want to be recognized for my fine efforts, for my work. So I persuaded him that we were going to write a paper I had never written a paper ever since. It's the only paper I ever wrote. And I wrote it. I'm a good writer. But it was his work. And we wrote it. We submitted it to the Design Automation Conference. We got top three papers in the conference. And one of the top three nominated. And he got recognition from Berkeley and Stanford and Intel. And he got what he wanted. And I persuaded him that's but I had to understand that's how he was motivated. And I think you need to use that technique. At the end of the day, Lincoln was the commander-in-chief, make no mistake, and he made the call. But if he could get people lined up, then he's got the team working the same way. If I have to coerce Kobe or Shaq to do something to work with each other rather than persuade them, as the Zen master did, we're not winning the championships. There's no way.
So as a mathematician and coding, how did you get from that point to being a leader and end up teaching, leading to other people?
Yeah, I got asked this question. So believe it or not, I never wanted to be a leader. I know that sounds weird. I was at Silicon Graphics, and I was an individual contributor. I worked, any people out there, programmers, engineers, raise your hand. Okay, I was a software engineer. I did compilers, debuggers, performance analysis tools, core systems that helped help programmers who used our systems build their code, right? And we were going from 32 bits to 64 bits, a new chip architecture, and you think this would be easy. Well, it's not. And the team that was trying to make these compilers and tools work choked miserably. And they came to me as an engineer, and they said, this is how Silicon Graphics works. They said, you need to build a team to get us onto 64 bits because we're holding up hundreds of millions of dollars worth of hardware. Remember, Silicon Graphics was a computer company, and we're holding up shipment because we don't have the tools, right? And you're going to do it. I said, well, what if I don't want to do it? Then you're fired. That's how they worked. So I built two teams, and we actually went into day shift, night shift, which is a rare thing for a company back then. This is before the internet. And we worked round the clock because time was of the essence because we were not shipping gear. And I got all these VPs saying, I want to ship my computers, but we can't ship them without the tools. And I handpicked the team, two teams, Team A and Team B, and that was more so working shifts. And in 3 months, we built a minimal viable product. And we shipped, and we were heroes. And Silicon Graphics was very good about rewarding their heroes. And I became a leader that day. The interesting thing was, at that point, I realized, as much as I love engineering, how many more things could I get accomplished with these teams? It was demonstrated to me that we did it. And I got these people to do things they never thought they could do. And I thought, maybe if I could do that at a broader scale, I can even do more. It was a hard decision, though. I will tell you, if you ask Kevin Scott at LinkedIn, does he miss programming? He does program anyway. So do I. I still programmed at LinkedIn. I submitted to Hack Day 3 times. But do we miss it? Yeah, we miss it. We miss it. I know it sounds nerdy, but we do. But I realized I could get more accomplished if I had enough people like-minded. And that's the day I changed. I programmed for 25 years, and then I changed on that moment.
All right, we have time for two more. We got one in the middle here.
If you're only as good as your lieutenants, what is the resonating quality that you must see in the people you're choosing for a team?
I think, obviously, they have to be capable, right? With LinkedIn, we're pretty anal about hiring the best people, and I'm sure every company will say that. LinkedIn does it. Okay, so they have to be capable. But they also have to be culturally a fit, right? I can have the smartest guy on the face of the planet, and if he tells me he can't work as a team with his team, no way I'm going to hire him. And that's very important, because whether it's a police force or the university or a company, all these people have to work together, because if anyone doesn't, the team will fail. And everybody knows it. So we can't have it. So the cultural fit is equally important to they're both requirements. The cultural fit and the capability fit. I want the best possible people on the planet, and I want the cultural fit to be right. And by the way, that's the culture that we're trying to build here. LinkedIn has a different culture than Facebook, which has a different culture than Google. I'm okay with that. But for us, that's very important.
All right, so
I'm willing to take questions as long as you want.
I had a question queued up, but I guess it was the question you were just asked, so you're on.
It seems like the corporate environment tends to create a suboptimal culture. Can you talk about what it takes to maintain an excellent culture as a company grows and grows?
I can not only talk about it, I can show you. So this is LinkedIn's culture. I thought I might get asked this. Is that still working? Maybe I did it wrong. All right. This is actually word for word LinkedIn's culture. Mission: connect the world's professionals to make them more productive and successful. Vision: create economic opportunity for every professional in the world. Opportunity: connect talent with opportunity at massive scale. Those five operating priorities are gone over every 2 weeks at the all hands. Values: this is where it gets more interesting to me. Our members come first, minus the comma. Relationships matter: open, honest, constructive, demand excellence, take intelligent risks, act like an owner. I love this one, act like an owner. If you're an owner on LinkedIn, yippee. Culture, transformation, world self, world company itself, integrity, collaboration, humor, results. That's part of our culture too. Metrics, we talked about what gets measured gets fixed. That's how we measure everything at LinkedIn. That's it. We have a one-page document. Do you think I can't use that every day as a leader? And for every decision I ever make, I use this every day to run the site. But let's suppose we're doing something that's not members first. We're going to make much more money, but it's not members first. We're not doing it. That's wrong. We're not going to do it because that's not who we are. That's not our culture. The other part is the startup, right? We get asked a lot, how did you go from 200 to 1,600 in 4 years, engineers? Or in this case, when I got there, I think there were 500 people in the company, and now there's 6,600 people in the company, right? That's hypergrowth, 4 years, and maintain that culture. We do it because we reinforce this all the time. We do hack days. We try to keep the entrepreneurial spirit injected in everyone. We bring in a lot of young talent all the time. That's one of the reasons I come here. That's the primary reason I came to UCSB. We have an intern program and a new college graduate program. Guess what percentage of our engineers come out of that program? Hires, 35%. I bring them from UCSB, UCLA, MIT, Carnegie Mellon, and so forth and so on. Without them, there's no way we could have achieved what we did. And we need them to understand our culture and be part of that culture. We try to maintain the entrepreneurship and the innovation by using the hack days. We also have a special program that if you qualify, you get to stop working on what you're working on and you can work on your project. And you have to vie for it, like in a contest. And we reinforce it. The other thing is, people ask Jeff Weiner why he repeats the same thing at every all hands. You know why? Two reasons. People don't understand anything you said until you say it 41 times. The second reason is we have a lot of new people coming in. They've never heard this before. And they need to know that they're part of this team too. So we thought a lot about this, because you can't grow that fast without having control over the quality level of the people you're bringing in, the leadership level, which we were actually more concerned about, who's going to manage all these new people, and keeping our culture and honoring it. But that's it, right? There's a 150-page document for Netflix culture, PowerPoint. Go read it and just do a diff of that with that, and you tell me which one you like better.
David, thank you so much. That was fantastic.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.